Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. Joining us today is a legendary singer. He's been with Rainbow, MSG, his own band Alcatraz, of course. And joining him today is his girlfriend, Bethany. Welcome, guys. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
I said that very nicely, didn't I?
Yeah. You did.
Very proper.
Best Roger Moore. Hello. Sorry.
No.
Roger Moore, where did you get that accent from? He gave it to David Coverdale.
and he ran away.
I thought it was David talk, because David used to talk like this.
Yes.
Hello, you all right? But suddenly he sounds like Roger Moore. Don't tell him this.
He started watching reruns of The Saint, and then he developed that accent.
Yeah.
The show The Saint that he was in, Roger Moore?
No. What is that?
Oh, The Saint? Yeah, it was a show in the 60s. That's where Roger Moore started, early 60s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry, yes.
The Saint, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Right over.
The little halo.
That was before James Bond. Yeah, way before James Bond. Yeah, The Saint.
There was a woman called Dorothy Squires, who was a singer in England, and she saw this guy who was modeling, and that was Roger Moore.
Oh, really?
Got a career together as an actor. You know, she fancied him or something. I'm not quite sure she actually went out with him, but Rosemary Squires is one of my mum's favorite singers.
Interesting.
Had a really big voice, sort of a dark brown voice, like the Kinks would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of rich. And that's how he got his career started, was through Rosemary Squires. So there
you go. All right.
What a wonderful piece of information.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That's a good way to start it off.
Yes, I remember all these things from when I was a little kid. It's so ridiculous, isn't it? Anyway, Bethany, say something.
Well, you guys you guys are dealing with COVID right now. How's that going? How you feeling?
Well, Bethany,
we tested negative yesterday, so.
Oh, good.
Well, she did. That was today, wasn't it?
Well, we're one person, so.
Yeah.
That was today.
That was this morning. See how our memory's gone now. When you get older, you know.
Yeah, that's right. So,
but yeah, I am.
We're a couple Jersey guys. Bethany, you're a Jersey girl, right?
Yep. Yeah. Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Nice. So, are you looking forward to coming back? You got some shows next month here?
I am so excited, especially for the Landis. And I've been getting in touch with friends from high school going, you got to be there. Come on. I'm going to play naked. You got to be there, you know?
That's cool. I know you've been there a couple times.
I have been there. I saw Glenn Hughes there. I saw the Dead Daisies there. Yeah.
What kind of place is it? Is it nice?
It's a really nice theater. Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Oh, okay.
Yeah, very nice.
To bring bodies in there, so that's why I'm going to tell people.
You know, it's kind of the thing with it. It's a very nice theater, but there's not a lot around there. So it's like people have to travel to get there. It's not you're not going to draw just by people generally in the area. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's kind of a little tiny town and, you know, but it's a very nice theater. And they book a lot of bands. They really are booking a lot of bands there.
I'm looking forward to it, but that's just what's been happening too much. You know, people say, oh, we didn't know you were playing here.
Yeah.
But why? I mean, what? Yeah, well, nobody lives around here, really. We find that it's happening. We go to a little village in the middle of nowhere, and there's a gig that nobody really goes to, especially on a weekday. Weekends are the best ones, but we've had lots of gigs that have been in the middle of the week, and, you know, very sort of, the audience isn't, like, packed.
Yeah.
The story of life is that there's somebody who's a little bit bigger of a name playing down the road the same day.
Yeah.
You know, that happens constantly, or, you know, just people didn't know we were playing. So, you know, I already wear eight hats, so I'm trying to, you know, wear the ninth promotion hat, but it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah. But I'm hoping this one's going to be good. We have, you know, we're going to be talking to somebody else later tonight who I forgot what paper they're associated with, but like a New Jersey arts paper is going to, you know, I don't know, whatever, man, anything. I'll tell stories. I have to tell you, I miss certain aspects of growing up in South Jersey and, you know, having four seasons. And there was this place called the Cowtail Bar, and it was a dairy farm that you could go eat, and they would make the most glorious milkshakes I've ever had in my life. And
oh, wow.
Back to being a little kid and just being out in nature and how different it is for like my kids, how I raised my kids. You couldn't be out all the time, you know?
Yeah.
LA smoggy for one thing. So I'm just looking forward. It's not going to be the same. I know it won't look the same and it won't feel the same, but it will always be home to me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'm actually got tickets to see you guys at the Sellersville Theater in Pennsylvania. Beautiful place. If you talked about, you want to know it, that's a great place. And from what I hear, they treat the bands top notch. They're just like a great venue.
That's something we've missed a little bit. Yeah, because when we do like a million gigs in a row, some of the venues backstage, we don't get anything. You know, it's like, well, where's the, are we getting food later? We'll give you a couple of bucks each and go and fend for yourselves. You know, it's not like it used to be. You know, when I was a little lad in Rainbow, I was spoiled, you know, and yeah. I'm looking for that again, but it's not going to happen again. That's a once in a lifetime thing. You know, we all had dressing rooms and, we had a vegetarian chef on the road with us and a regular chef, you know, it's like spoiled. We're like little babies, you know, all we had to do was go out there and play. Yeah. Everything was, you know, and I didn't expect that when I joined the band because I was so not like the rest of the band. I stuck out like a sore bloody thumb, you know, my short hair and my 1950s gear and all that shit, you know, I mean, I was into doo-wop, you know. Yeah. I liked R&B and stuff, but the reason I got the job in the band is because of a song that the Bee Gees wrote for me and my cousin back in 1968. It's a song called Only One Woman, which is kind of like an R&B song. I don't know if you ever heard it.
Oh, yeah.
Was that with the Marbles that you did?
Yeah, the Marbles. Yeah. That's my cousin Trevor. And he was in the Bee Gees in Australia. And what happened was me and Trevor were playing with our band in a place called the Revolution Club in London. And after we finished playing, this guy comes up and said, "Hi, Trevor, how are you?" You know, with a very sort of Japanese accent. No, he said, "Trevor, how are you doing, mate?" You know, and Trevor goes, "Huh, Ozzy Burner," I think his name was. He said, "Yeah, hey, I think Barry and Robin and Morris would love to see you." And he gave my cousin their telephone number in London, Barry's number. And so Trevor went over like next day and met up with his old friends who we haven't seen for years because they made records together. It was Trevor Gordon and the Bee Gees, it was called, on the Leiden label in Australia.
Wow.
And which I used to get all the time. He would send me these singles of this little band called the Bee Gees. Little band. My God, look what happened. It was something that I thought, they sound great. They sound like the Beatles almost. He said, yeah, that's what they're trying to be. They want to be like the Beatles.
Hmm.
Anyway, they moved over to England, and my cousin Trevor stayed over in Australia. But when he came over to England, my cousin, as I said, he met up with Barry, and he's singing away with Barry and Morris and Robin in Barry's apartment. And they finished playing, and Robert Stigwood was there also, the manager. And my cousin said, "Oh, well, my cousin Graham sings too, you know." "Oh, yeah." I said, "Well, we don't want a band." "No," but he said, "I want to bring my cousin over," because we were like five guys at the time. And so I went over like a couple of days later, and the guitars came out, of course, and we're playing Stevie Wonder tunes and Beach Boys and Beatles and whatever you like. And Robert Stigwood was there again and said to Barry, "Do you have a tune for these boys? I'd like to start recording with them." And that was the beginning of the Marbles, so to speak, which I hated that name. Robert Stigwood came up with the name, "What about Gravy Train?" And Barry says, no, I'm thinking more, what about Marbles?
The Marbles, yeah. He saved his good names for blind faith, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what? You know, I thought it was a terrible name, and I still do, kind of. But if it wasn't for the Gibb brothers, I wouldn't be talking to you now, I don't think. You know?
Okay.
I mean, Barry was a great friend of mine. I've been trying to get in touch with him for years. But he's not he's not very personable right now because of all the disasters he's had happening to his family. He's broken, you know, poor guy.
Yeah.
So I spoke to his road tour manager about, I don't know, about a month ago or so. And I told him we're going to play in Florida. I said, do you think Barry will come along? He said, I don't think so. I don't think Barry would come and go out at all, you know. Wow. He's very private. And I understand completely. I mean, if Barry Gibb walked into some of the gigs we played, people go, what are you doing?
Right.
They'd be very surprised, you know, because he's not a metal guy. Barry's more of an R&B pop sort of a guy. You know, he loves all that stuff. And the tune he wrote for me and Trevor was... it went to number three in England and did really well on Sur le Continent in Europe, you know. It was never released in America, which really disappointed the both of us, because I think it would have gone really well here because that British invasion thing was happening. You know, Peter Gordon and all those guys, it was, to me, were very like, ew. You know, we blew them away. We did, you know. But it didn't happen. Unfortunately, it was something... I actually recorded with my band Alcatraz years ago. We redid it with Richie Podler, who was our producer at the time. Richie's he's died now. But he was the guy that played... He played Wipeout, you know. Mm-hmm. And he had a studio in Calabasas here. And he said, well, why don't we re-record that song you did when you were 18 years old, or 19, whatever you were. And so we re-recorded it. And it's not too bad, actually, the Alcatraz thing. But that was the last Alcatraz album as such, because Danny Johnson was our guitar player at that time, and it was all a bit thrown together. But that particular song came out pretty well, you know. I was surprised, because I didn't want to record it again. The first recording's always the best, you know.
Yeah.
Because it has enthusiasm and whatever, and it's fresh.
Sure, yeah.
I'll stop now, actually.
So starting with Rainbow, the question I wanted to ask you was, when Dio had left Rainbow, it was out there that Richie Blackmore wanted the band to start to becoming more commercial, and he wanted to record commercial music. I don't necessarily hear that on the album that you were on. I mean, there were one or two songs that were commercial. When you came into the band, was there that mantra that we want to be more commercial, or was that really not in play?
Absolutely. Bruce Payne, the manager, had this song he wanted the band to record, which was... Since You've Been Gone, of all songs, you know. I mean, now that's become like the Rainbow anthem. I mean, talk about Rainbow, you think of Since You've Been Gone, and I was very lucky to be the one that sang it. And everybody nicks it and said, oh, you must be kidding. Cozy Pelham going, oh, fucking no. No, don't even talk about it, you know. It's like that. And when we did record it, our manager just came in and said, this is a freaking hit record. And it broke Rainbow into everyday radio, which wasn't happening before. It became radio friendly, which Rainbow wasn't. I'd never heard of Rainbow in England at all. I didn't know who they were. I knew Richie from Deep Purple, but that's all I knew. And when I heard of Rainbow, I thought it was a folk group or something. when somebody asked me, he said, well, do you want to go and have an audition with Rainbow? I said, well, what? What's Rainbow? And somebody explained to me that it's kind of like a semi-classical, neoclassical, whatever, band, you know. And I thought, well, what the hell's that? So anyway, I went over and I got the job eventually. But, you know, what I felt, what the fuck am I talking about?
Rainbow.
Rainbow. And it was a weird thing that I remember I had to go and buy the Rainbow albums. So I bought all the albums that... Ronnie was on, and I listened to it. And I thought, well, I don't sing like that. That's not me. You know, I don't sing in that way, blah, 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 et cetera. I just didn't think it was right. But anyway, I went over, did the audition. And the reason I got the audition was because of the song that Barry Gibb wrote, the song Only One Woman. That was one of Richie's favorite songs. And they were playing Spot the Tune one night with a cassette machine, and Cozy had all these tapes. And he put it in there. He said, okay, who's this guy? And Richard goes, where is he? Where is he now? Ah, he's managed by the same group that manages, Bernie Marsden and Mickey Moody and Rory Gallagher. And so they got in touch. Roger Glover got in touch with me and said, could you come over and do an audition with us, you know? And so I learned one song called Mistreated, and that was my party piece. And they gave me the job, didn't they, Bethel?
Yes, I was there. No,
I'm not. You were a mere child then. You were about 3 years old.
Exactly.
Somewhere in New Jersey.
It wasn't for, again, if it wasn't for Barry Gibb writing that bloody tune and it being in the fucking, what's it called, the movie of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
It was in that movie. Since You've Been Gone.
Huh? Since You've Been Gone.
Yeah, but that was Russ Ballard.
Oh, that was Russ Ballard. Sorry. But I mean,
oh my God, I'm scared.
Yeah, I'm getting scared now, but it was Russ Ballard.
When you were in Rainbow, did you kind of know that that this was going to be like a one and done, and you wanted to kind of do your own thing? Or did you see yourself doing 3 or 4 albums like Dio had done with him?
No, I thought it was going to be just like a one-off recording album,
right?
Because I was doing my own solo stuff at that time, and again, Richie liked a track off of one of my solo albums, which was Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? You know, the old tune.
Yes.
Tonight you're mine. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to his house once, and he was playing that to her. He had a party in one night. He was playing this, and he played it again and again. And Roger Glover was there. I said, why the fuck is he playing that song over and over again for? He's playing it to his friends. I said, yeah, but do they really want to hear it like 12 times? He said, but Richie loves that. You know, so eventually it became part of the Rainbow Show. We threw that in once in a while, that song.
Right, it was on the DVD. There's a little interlude where that song gets interspersed in the middle of it.
Yeah. I didn't know we were going to do it. And it was, is that the Castle Donington?
The Castle Donington, yeah.
Yeah, because we didn't rehearse it or anything, you know. We obviously rehearsed it in rehearsal when we were just, you know, rehearsing. But we never actually did it live. You know, and then I heard Richie playing a D chord, and he looks across at me and he goes, I'll go, what? Oh, shit. You really want to do this? And I started singing it. I thought, well, the band doesn't know it, do they? Yes, they did. They secretly rehearsed it behind my back. And
okay.
I didn't think it was very good, but it's not too bad. You know, yeah. I prefer the studio version. But,
beautiful.
Yeah, but it didn't I was taken aback, or a front, or a side, or something. And, you know, and my mom and dad were there, and my brother out in the audience, you know, and everybody was there, all my friends, etc. And my mom said that my brother Tony was singing it along with me. And I said, oh, bless his heart. You know,
because when you left, you started you did an album called Lineup.
Yeah.
Mark, I think, has a few questions he wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
Well, no, like you had indicated that you didn't think this was going to be a long-term thing with Rainbow. No. And right after that, you do the Lineup album. And you had some great players in that. I mean, obviously, Cozy Powell was on it. John Lord did a little bit. You had Mickey Moody, right? Talk about that album, because, you know, it kind of came before you went to MSG shortly after. But that was what you were looking to do, kind of continue to be a solo artist.
Basically, because that's what I was doing before Rainbow. You know, I was doing solo stuff,
right,
which never really happened in England, but happened in Australia and like Japan and New Zealand, all over the place, you know, Germany, etc., but never in England. It's always seems that when I record something, it never becomes popular at home, like here, you know, because I moved here in 79. And, you know, the only thing that I hear on the radio now is Just Since You've Been Gone, you know.
Yeah.
All Night Long, sorry. Those two songs are played once in a while. But that was, what am I saying?
Lineup album.
Who am I?
You are Graham.
Well, I actually didn't want to spend that much time on the Lineup album. I wanted to spend more time on Alcatraz. So, like, if.
well, before we do that, let's go to MSG, right?
The Lineup album is one of my favorite albums.
Okay.
I'll get making that because, unfortunately, Alcatraz came along, which is now being destroyed by whomever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to that. We must go to MSG. And I always felt MSG was the album where your vocal style of singing, which was like nobody else's, really came into play. Did you, at when you got that gig with him, did you feel at that time you like your ability to project and your vocal style was something you wanted to really put out?
Yeah. Well, because it was interesting to do the Rainbow album, because I thought, well, how am I going to sing these bloody songs?
Mm-hmm.
Because we wrote them in the studio. I mean, Roger would come up with an idea and some words. I never wrote the words, but the melodies I made up as I went along, basically. And Roger would give me a rough idea, you know, like on Eyes of the World or Lost in Hollywood, whatever the tracks are on that thing. And he would just say, Graham, take it your way. Now you do your bit, you know. But I was never credited for being a writer as such on that album. I didn't realize I was writing songs. I was just making it up as I went along, you know. I'd never been in a band this big before. I'd always just been Graham and Trevor, the Marbles.
Now, if you had to go back to that album, and I want to see if you think the same way I do, 1983. There were two albums that came out like around that time. The German band Accept, Restless and Wild, and this MSG album, which I thought were at the time cutting edge for heaviness in hard rock music. Did you feel like when you guys were cutting that MSG album, and your vocals especially, which were phenomenal? Did you feel like you were really setting the stage, because you were setting the stage for a different level of heaviness at that time?
Yeah. Well, I don't think Michael knew what I could do, and I didn't know what I could do lyrically and melodically, because I'd relied on Roger Glover with the other albums, you know, with the other album. And I surprised myself, actually, because I said to Michael, well, I'm not sure I can write the right kind of words for this kind of music, you know. And he said, yes, you can, Graham. You know, he says, because I can't write English. You know, you just said, you've got to do it because I'm German. You know, all right then, Michael, thank you very much. I will do it. So I remember sitting, we were rehearsing, and it was all loud and groovy and fabulous one late night. And I'm sitting on the side of the room just listening to them playing. And Michael looks at me and says, can you think you can make up something to this song? And I said, I don't know. And so I was sitting there, I had some paper or something, obviously, to write on. And these words just came to my head for no apparent reason. And it turned out to be a song called Desert Song.
Oh,
and
that was the first lyric
I ever wrote.
And I'm tremendous just going, song.
We're sailing, what kind of, I had to think about, what do they call a camel? Oh, it's a ship. You call a camel a ship.
Mm-hmm.
We're sailing ships across the desert. And something around, and that's
the Arabian moon.
Yeah, so I had to do it because nobody else would. Nobody else was writing the melodies or making up the words. So I'd already felt I'd found my niche, so to speak. I really thought I fit in well because of my experience with Rainbow. You know, Rainbow gave me that. Oh, I know what's going to happen here. I knew how the arrangements to those kind of songs went. Wasn't necessary. Oh, here comes the verse, here comes the chorus, and now the middle bit. But it was all in different sections. And Michael Schenker always writes songs with very interesting progression.
You know, like the song Assault Attack, I can tell you, right, from when I bought that album in 1983, living in Brooklyn with all these metalheads that I hung around with. That song, when that album got out there, that was like, holy shit, have you heard this? Like, it was so cutting edge for that time. It was so, because Schenker had never done, even with UFO, Schenker never did anything that heavy as that album. Well, and with your vocals attached and the rhythm section between those two guys.
Absolutely.
And the production of Martin Birch.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
The Martin separation Birch on the bass and the drums. And that album had such an effect on a heavy metal crowd at that era.
Yeah. I never thought that would happen. I always thought it was like it was just another album, like a pop album almost.
Oh, no, God, that was a great
heavy
record.
Or whatever. It was pretty, you know, out there.
The song Samurai? I mean, Samurai was like, when you heard that, it was like, you just like felt your knees.
And Martin was just the greatest producer.
It's fantastic. Perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, the production on that album is just ridiculous.
Yeah. And, you know, Ted McKenna playing drums after Cozy left, you know. And poor Ted, as we know.
Yeah, no, it's awful what happened to him. And Ted McKenna really lived in the shadow of Cozy. He was every bit as good as Cozy Powell was, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But he lived in the shadow of Cozy.
But what a job he did on that album.
Oh, like, I mean, and the bass playing. Forget it.
Such a lovely man. You know, I introduced him to Bethany one night when we started on the road with the Shanker Show, and she loved him straight away because he's a very nice Scotsman. You know,
Great
storyteller. Yeah. And he went in for a minor operation. And as we all know.
It's awful. Awful what happened to him.
But the album itself, with Chris playing bass, Ted drums, you know, I mean, Michael playing guitar, and me singing. Everybody was just, you know, Martin Birch just said, this is fucking great.
It really was. He loved it.
If the dude loves it, then you're on the right track, I think, especially someone like Martin, who produced some great records in the past anyway, you know. And Martin's gone now. It's like, who's next? Mm. Not me. I don't want to go next.
No, I won't.
No, she's not going to let me down. She's going to kill me.
I call him the cockroach of rock. Like, you can't.
Well, that's what happens. Yeah. Now, you get to a certain point, you know you're going to go for a long time because you've outlived all the other obstacles in your world.
Yeah. But, you know, it's I've just been very, very lucky to have that job that in fact, Cozy got me with Michael Shanker. Cozy was in the band at the time.
No, I know. I read it in your book. Yeah.
FM station, I think it was, in L.A. And after they finished their show, Cozy came up. I was on the balcony, and he said to me, what do you think of the band? I said, oh, it's fucking great, man. Great songs, everything. I said, you're playing amazingly. He said, yeah, it's not bad, is it? Would you like to sing with us? It was kind of like that was it.
Right.
And I said, what do you mean? I said, you got Gary singing for you. He said, but we've been talking and we'd like you to come and sing with us. So it wasn't because Gary was bad.
Gary was good, but that album was in my opinion, as a fan of you, that was your coming out party. That was not even so much the Rainbow album. That album put your stamp of vocals that have lasted a lifetime.
Oh, thank you.
That album. Yeah.
Well, that's nice because I did work hard on that because I'd never written lyrics and melodies on my own, you know. Well, melodies, yes, but not words, you know, stories for songs, you know. That's where Desert Song came up, and I just sort of let my imagination roll, you know, with sailing ships across the desert. What comes next? What's the next fucking line? You know. But that album, yes, it was hard work for me, and I really put my heart into it. You know, I really did. I wanted to please Martin and especially Michael.
We know it didn't work out, you know, long term with you and Shanker, but how did the Alcatraz project initially come together with the guys from New England and then Malmsteen? If you could take us a little bit of how that lineup came together.
Yeah. Well, my manager then was a guy called Andy Truman. He used to manage Jethro Tull, the Bay City Rollers, etc. He had a bunch of people, Robert Palmer. He had a bunch of people he used to manage. And one of my friends told me that he'd be a great manager for us. So, for me. And so I said, well, I don't have a band. And he said, well, let's get a band together. And I said, how? He said, well, just look around. We'll look, you know, in the fucking music papers for people who, you know, advertising, I'm a guitar player and I've got my own van, you know, or whatever, you know.
Right.
And actually, he did find he wanted to get the band to be like a super group in a way. So we found people who had done something spectacular or, you know, sort of well-known within the music business, you know, like, our drummer, Jan Uvina, eventually, he was with Alice Cooper. These two guys that we met from a band called New England, we found them in a music magazine, keyboard player and bass player. And they had a minor hit with a song called Don't Ever Want to Lose You. Mm-hmm. These two guys too. And now we're going to look for a guitar player and possibly, you know, just a guitar player, basically. And we looked at everywhere. Paul McCartney's, what's his face, the guitar player?
Lawrence
Juber. He came on, he rehearsed with us in the house, and a bunch of other guys. But I remember him because Lawrence was very business savvy. And our manager wanted to pull the wool over everybody's eyes about the money and this, that, and the other, you know, the insides and outsides of the music business. And so Lawrence started questioning him. And he refused the job, actually. He said, no, I don't like this guy. You know, he's too, he'll rip you off. And of course he did, which all managers did.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know. So, but, I mean, eventually it came together because of Yngwie. And when we found Yngwie through a friend of somebody else, you got to hear this guy Yngwie. He's a guitar player with his own band, blah, blah, blah. And he's like 18 years old. But he's a big Ritchie Blackmore fan. And I said, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And so we brought him along to the studio where we're rehearsing. And I spoke to him on the phone first. And he said, no, is this really Graham? I said, yes, it is. Yes, Graham. Graham Bonnet, you know, the guy with the hat. And he said, no, somebody's playing a fool with me. I said, no. Honestly, anyway, I want you to come along to the rehearsal at blah, 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 whatever it was, the address. And I said, I'd like you to listen to my solo album, Lineup. I want you to listen to a song called SOS. And could you learn that and play that? Because I didn't want to hear someone who's going to go, mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want to see what it'd be like without doing all the widdly widdlies, you know. And he came along, he'd learned that tune perfectly. And I said, that's fucking great. That's great. And I said, okay, now let's do, you know, a rainbow tune or something, you know. All Night Long or whatever, you know. So he did, and he just blew me away and all the other guys. It was just like, this fucking guy's amazing. And of course he was. He was just, he was too good for the band almost, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my opinion, that playing that he did on that first Alcatraz album to this day is the best playing he's ever done. Because he played melodic. He played for the songs.
Yeah.
He didn't play these crazy solos that made absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
And if you listen to everything he did post that album, it was a spiral descent of just self-indulgent crap, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's a great player. No doubt he's a fucking amazing player. But you're right. On that first album, I remember saying to our producer at the time, I said, do you know why I like him? He takes little bits of my melody
mm-hmm.
and he puts it in the solo.
The solos were great on that album.
Chanka does all of them. Yeah, which is a compliment to what I'm singing. You know, he's not just going to, you know, for the hell of it. He actually, I agree with you. I think that's the best play he's done too.
Yes.
Not because I was in the freaking band.
He's never done, because he's never done anything like that, where he really played for the song.
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as he left Alcatraz, it completely changed.
I think Bethany spotted that. You said something about him.
Well, I'm just not a big Weedly Weedly fan, as he calls it, but I feel like Yngwie really does have something to say on that record. Yeah. And
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, Suffer Me. Oh my God.
Yeah. I remember writing that song, that ballad, Suffer Me, with Yngwie one afternoon. I had my little guitar plugged into my little H&H amplifier. And we're in the rehearsal room, and sitting on the stage in the rehearsal room, and he was playing, I don't know, something or other, nothing in particular. And he said to me, Graham, do an E minor seventh. I said, oh, okay. So I had my acoustic electric guitar plugged in. So I did this E minor seventh. He said, just keep playing on that. And that's it. And then he did some changes. I said, well, that's cool. And the song was born that afternoon with me and him. It was just like, I said, you know, this is a ballad. Do you know what it makes me think of? My mom. It makes me think of my mom. And he said, it does me too. Can we write this song about our mothers? You know, So the songs are basically about his mom, my mom, you know, how we were born and how
mm-hmm.
they started our naughtiness and stuff in the past as being little kids, you know. So like, you know, mine was the cold December day I came. You knew me well, though I was a stranger. You know, because she carried me for 9 months, but she knew me well. You know, it was all little things like that that it made Yngwie cry, to be honest with you. He said, that's beautiful.
Hmm.
I'm telling you that now because I was very proud of that moment. because I admired him as a musician as well as anything else. Nice. He was a good kid. He actually understood what I was getting at.
Well, that was a groundbreaking album at that time. That album really, I mean, even going beyond the MSG album, because now we're a year or two past that, that guitar playing was pretty cutting edge at the end, at the beginning, because there wasn't really that many guys doing that yet. And what I always used to call the Alcatraz albums, the one you did with Steve Vai also, was Thinking Man's Metal. The songs made you really, a song I always loved was General Hospital. And you had to listen to it wasn't the usual bullshit of, you know, women and, you know, and drinking. You. And they were all songs that you really like, what is this guy talking about? You had to really go into the album and read the lyrics and try to figure out, you know, what the story was behind this. And I always referred to those albums as Thinking Man's heavy metal.
Heavy metal. That's what I did. I said that in an interview, you know, and I'm glad you picked up on that. And it was because, you know, I wanted not to do what everybody else was doing, you know, talking about Dungeons and Dragons and chains and big swords and something. Whips and chains, you know. I thought, you know, it's like writing a song about Jack and the Beanstalk or something. It was all very fairy tale, you know. I mean, bless his heart, Ronnie, that was his thing.
Yeah.
Ron Dio, you know, the man on the Silver Mountain and all that kind of thing. That wasn't me. Mm. I said, let me write some songs about my experiences and, you know, other people's experiences, but about real life. You know, there's a song called General Hospital, which is about me being in the hospital.
Right.
You know, and what I went through, and said, I don't want this. I'm getting out of there because I was... They said, you've got to stay here, Mr. Bonnet. You can't go now. I said, I'm fucking off. I'm getting... It was a London hospital called the Whittington, which is like a fucking jail. Mm. Had green walls with like black lines along it with a cream. It looked like a shit house, you know. It really did. And I got out of the bed and the nurse stopped me. She said, no, you've got to see your doctor. We've got to... Because I'm epileptic. And I'd had a seizure and that's why I was in hospital. And she said, you can't go without seeing your doctor first. And no, I'm getting out of here. This place is horrible, you know. And my girlfriend picked me up and we went home. But I shouldn't have done that. It was very bad of me to do it because they wanted to make sure I was okay. Mm. So I'd never had a seizure before that was this drastic. It was a, you know, grand mal thing, you know. Wow. And then I got put on the drugs, you know. I'm on phenytoin now and I've been pretty good. But you never know when it's going to pop up.
Yeah.
But that's I really appreciate what you said there about the words and everything, because I'm doing stuff now for our new album. I read some words to Bethany this morning or yesterday, didn't I?
You sure did.
Yeah, and I like it to read, like, you know, to read good as well as sing good. And sometimes I've changed that one song about three times since I made it up with Conrad. Over the past week or two, because I change it all the time because I go, no, that word reads great, but it doesn't sing good. Too many syllables, too many, I don't know, can I sing it and make it sound that I mean it? Mm. You know, it sounds like I'm really like, oh, serious about stuff. I am, because I know how my voice is. I know where it projects at its best. I know which notes are the best notes for me, et cetera, et cetera. I know when I can do a really good vibrato and where I should breathe, where I can go very high and where I can go, you know, mid range. So I always crafted the songs in that way, not necessarily all, you know, all the time screaming and yelling, because that anybody can do that, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that.
Now, it seemed from the MSG album into Alcatraz, you were kind of taken up with the Japanese culture and the Japanese history. Is that correct?
Yeah. Say that again.
The Japanese culture and the we saw it with Samurai in the MSG album, and then it was really carried over into the Alcatraz period that you were caught up with the Japanese traditions and the Japanese culture. And again, those songs were very so interesting to listened to about the, you know, the bombing and everything in Japan. And it was very Definitely. Different from what anything else was in heavy metal at the time, because at that time it was really the advent of Iron Maiden and Priest, and not to take anything away from those bands, but there was nobody that was writing at that depth that you were, that really, it added another dimension to the heaviness of the music was the lyrics.
I agree. And I have a fan, don't I?
Me?
No, apart from you.
What do you mean? Oh, yeah. Bruce Dickinson loves Graham.
Dickinson's solo stuff is actually a lot deeper than some of the early Maiden stuff was.
He mentions me in his book and stuff. And,
yes, he does. Because I read his book last summer when I was on the cruise that I got COVID.
Well, we went to see him play, you know, he did a solo thing at the Whiskey, and we saw him play with the whole band at the...
One was like the Forum.
Forum, yeah.
A couple of times.
Yeah.
Iron Maiden.
But we've seen him a couple of times.
What a production.
But he's a good friend, and I love him as a singer. And
I do too.
On this person, I like him.
He's an incredible character. You read his book, it's just what this guy has done. His whole he's lived 100 lifetimes in 60 years.
Yeah, we've been together for 60 years. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I love him so. Yeah, we're gonna possibly do something.
Now we know, again, I don't want to ask you a lot of questions that other people have asked you 10,000 times. We know that Malmsteen left. And what I never realized, that I found out about it through your book, is that you initially wanted Chris Impellitteri to be the replacement, and the other three guys wanted Steve Vai, and you eventually gave in to Steve Vai, and you created another monumental album that was every bit as good as the one before it, and maybe even better. Could you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah. I agree, absolutely. I loved working with Steve. It was a breath of fresh air, and he was always surprising. And I would come up with little ideas, and he'd go, "Oh, that's great. Let me just embellish on that." And one afternoon, we came up with a song called What's it called? Will You Be Home Tonight? I had a bass part. It went, and I said, da-da-da-da, like a blues line. And Steve goes, wait, let me just bring this chord in here. And we made up the whole song within about 10 minutes, the melody, you know, because he changed all these chords and he got away from the blues thing I was doing. And he came in and, you know, it turned into, will you be home tonight? You know, all these great chords he plays. And that was the first song we made up, me and him, in his studio in his house. But that, to me, is my favorite Alcatraz album. The first one was a tryout, if you know what I mean. We had a great guitar player, no freaking doubt, who went on to better things, which I knew he would, you know. He didn't want to stick around the guys that were in the band at the time. Neither did I much. But, But so, you know, Yngwie became what he deserved, and he's still out on the road now. And, you know, but he did a great job on that album with us. And, Steve thing, I was just amazed by the ideas he came up with, because he'd been working with Frank Zappa, and he was different, just a different kind of guy, and had ideas that I had in my head but never actually said anything about it, if you know what I mean, because I thought people would laugh at me. You know, well, you can't do that. You can't do, that's not very heavy, is it? No, it's not. I know it's not. But, you know, well, on the last album we did, we've got a song in 3/4. You don't have a heavy rock song in waltz time. Of course you bloody well can. It doesn't matter what the time signature is. It's the way it's performed. And it's all the same freaking notes. It's all the same chords. But it's put in a different way that you'll go, this is a great rock song. And, you know, I'm doing another one now. But that
was the song you were talking
about. The lyrics I was talking about this morning. I said, you know... It's called 3/4 time, which is 3/4 time. So it's it says, you know, vengeance is mine in 3/4 time is the first line. It rhymes as well, doesn't it? and I said, you don't need a backbeat to jive. Not rock, to jive. I use an old word. Mm-hmm. You don't need a backbeat to jive. something, something, something. I haven't recorded it yet, but I read it to.
Give it away.
No, I mean, but the story, you know, again, it's about real stuff. It's about real life, not about dragons and fucking guys with big swords.
So, you know? So when you gave in to the other three guys and you brought Vajen and you started to write that album, did you know that you were really onto something that was going to have a massive, you know, a long-term appeal?
Yeah, I knew that. Well, Steve knew, and he said to me, "This is going to be a fucking great album." Because what I used to do, we were recording at Cherokee in LA, and Eddie Kramer was our producer. And Steve said to me, "Let's go to another studio, a smaller studio, where you and I can work together." Oh, okay, we'll do that. So I did vocals with him, with Steve, you know, controlling the machine. And so, because there's one song on there that we did, it's all harmony, and the harmonies on the guitar are the harmonies on the voice. We blended them together. So the voice and the guitar are together, and it's like a 12-string voice guitar or something. But we did it together. It's a song called Breaking the Heart of the City, which is about the death of John Lennon.
Tremendous song.
You know it? Yeah, and we took it. We took all day doing that, me and Steve, I remember, because I had written the words at home, obviously. But he said, "No, great, great. You should do, see what I'm playing there? Oh, okay. That's a sixth. It's not a straight whatever, G or whatever bloody chord it was." So, no, that's a sixth. You put the sixth note in there, it gives it that jazz feel, but it's not jazz, you know. And that's the kind of ideas he came up with, you know. And he'd say, you know, like, "What's that note?" He would bang on the table. I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, Frank taught me this. Everything you hit with your hand has a note. Everything. Every object. Hmm. And that's the way we worked. I said, "Oh, that's fucking great."
Now, how did you work out that? I'm going to take you back to there was a DVD. Well, it became a DVD. Originally, it was a videotape of a show shot in Japan on that tour. And the stage presentation and your stage presence was otherworldly at the time. Between your vocals, Vi's stage presence, your stage presence, it's my all time favorite video. I've watched it 100 times. Oh. How did you guys choreograph that entire show, or was it just kind of like you just let it rip when you got out there?
Yeah. It was all, we're just fucking about, you know. I'll come over there. There's one point in the show. I don't know if it's on that thing, but he was playing that. He had a little mini guitar.
I was watching that today. Yeah. Just because I wanted to familiarize myself. It's the best part of the whole fucking DVD when he's playing this guitar this big that has this enormous sound, and he has these fingers that are this long that make the guitar look like it's this big.
Yeah. Well, one night, and I don't think it was in that show, I don't think. But anyway, one night, what Steve did, he took it from his round his neck and he throws it to me. And I start playing the blues. You know, I mean, I can play the blues like nobody's business, you know, because it's easy, it's simple, blah, 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 you know. And so I just started jamming with myself and singing a little bit, you know, doing my, what's the guy who sings with his guitar? Benson, George. George Benson, mm-hmm. You know, all that kind of thing, where the vocal is the same as the guitar part. And he sings with his guitar, George Benson. And Steve looks at me because I was getting carried away. I was just, you know, well, yeah, here I am, you know, playing this little guitar. And sorry, Steve. I stopped and I threw it back to him. It was kind of cool. But he caught it. I didn't think he would.
Bethany, have you seen this? Have you seen this DVD?
Yeah, I think I have. Yes.
No, I know you have. I'm asking her if she's seen it.
No.
You've never seen this?
I've seen videos. Is that the one? Does Steve have like a leopard print or an animal print shirt?
Yes, because Graham takes his shirt off, and he's got quite a stage show there.
You know, Japan is otherworldly as far as like the audience gets you just so pumped up.
Yeah, it's an incredible show. It really is. And I when you look at the fact that they only did that one album, it always, for me personally, it was like always you wanted that long, you know, partnership between Steve Vai and Graham Bonnet that never happened.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah, he's the king of the one, you know, one and done. And I wish that weren't the case, because I'd love to hear what another Rainbow song, or another Rainbow album, what that would have sounded like, especially another MSG song with Martin Birch producing it. And just that same, well, because to me, that is the most pristine album. I was actually curious. I was going to ask you, do you have a favorite on that album?
Breaking the Heart of the City.
No, on the MSG album.
Oh, on the MSG album. Probably Assault Attack, just for the heaviness of it.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Breaking the Heart of City. Yeah, that's one of my Breaking the Heart of City is my favorite one.
Yeah, you guys opened up with that show. That tour, you opened up with that song.
Yeah, and it's kind of the wrong thing to start with, because it's a slow tempo thing. We didn't come bursting onto the stage. It wasn't that, it was boom, boom.
I think the reason, I mean, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the reason you cut through so many of these guitar plays is because as you peaked as a singer, you obviously were in demand, and these guys were all just kind of becoming big names. Like, really, in the heavy metal crowd, nobody really knew that much about Steve Vai because he was with Frank Zappa. But when he cut the album with you, everybody knew about Steve Vai. Same thing with Malmsteen, same thing with Impellitteri. So, like, you were kind of were finding these guys that really weren't big names yet. Then they do an album with you, and then everybody, you know, in the heavy metal scene knew them.
Yeah, I know. Yes, it makes me cry sometimes, because I feel like I've been used as a stepping stone. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, right, because, like, your voice was in demand for these guys, and then they would, like, you know, Vi got the gig with Roth,
and they go on to better things.
Right.
But, you know,
I don't know about better. Maybe bigger, but not better.
Well, yes. More money.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There you go.
The money was the big, carrot on the end of a stick.
So you ended up, get your opportunity to do the album with Impellitteri, which was Stand in Line, which is another great album. If you could tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, that was, I think what happened at that point? Oh, I know. Yeah. Alcatraz had broken up. We had nothing to do, absolutely nothing. My ex-wife and my kids were going to Australia because I was making no money and she wasn't making any money. So I was on my own in Los Angeles, and I got this call from this guy. And he said, "Hi, my name's Chris." I said, "Pardon, what? What's your name?" "Chris Impellitteri." "Oh, yeah, okay." And he said, "Would you come along and play with my band, hang out for a bit?" And so that's what I did. I went along to see him and watch him play. And he played like a fucking buzzing bee.
Oh, yeah. And I was like,
crap, slow down. And
well, he was the next level of, like, it just kept going. At that time, the shredding just kept going up in levels to, like,
oh my God,
the point of insanity. Yeah.
Nobody could compete with that. It was like a bloody fly or something. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, I used to think, well, just play one bloody note. Just like,
right.
Do that. But because it all gets mushed together and like, what's that? Where are you going with that? And I remember we did one of our first gigs was with Billy Joel, the Tokyo Dome with Billy Joel. And Chris was practicing his parts in his dressing room, and Billy walks by and he says, "Have you killed that fucking thing yet?" And he was my friend ever since. You know, it's, that was a great show. But, I think Chris is just overdoing it. You know, I can play faster and I can play faster, but what is it if you play faster? Mm. It's not soulful. It doesn't really tell a story. It's just confusing people with noise and with, like, oh, yes, it's great the way you do that, but what kind of an emotion does it give me? Do I get happiness? Do I get whatever? It's mostly guitar players going, guitar players who don't think it's really fabulous, because they can't play that fast. But it doesn't mean anything. And I think he's slowed down a bit now.
It's not in vogue anywhere near as much as it used to be. I think it's one of those things that it kind of got to the point where everybody kind of got sick of it. And it doesn't have the level of appreciation that it did maybe 30, 35 years ago.
I know.
Not to mention there's videos of 7-year-olds doing it now.
Well, right. Exactly right. Yes. Right.
And it's just common ground, buddy, little kids. It's incredible. I mean, what I was saying, like when I was a kid, all I had was like the Ventures and the Shadows. You know, Apache. Yeah. And that's the way I learned to play. Dwayne Eddy, you know, guys. But now kids are hearing, and they're just doing what they're doing. They're just emulating the way people play guitar now. They don't play like a guitar anymore. They play it like this, you know, with the fingers on the, you know, all that. Won't do that.
Now, see, Steve Vai did that, but he did it in a very musical, melodic sense. He was another guy, and that one album you did with him, all his leads were for the song. They weren't really particularly self-indulgent.
Yeah, absolutely. He listened to the song.
Yes.
He listened to the words.
They were very musical, his leads.
Very much into the story of the song, I was saying before, you know. And I used to send the tapes home to my mum and dad, who was staying with me at the time in the States. And they come over for vacation. And I take, you know, a little demo tape back of the song we'd just done, you know, and I see what they thought about it, you know. Breaking the Heart of the City was one of them. But I said to them, you should see this guy play. He plays the guitar like a piano. And I'd never seen anybody play like that before. Mm-hmm. It was kind of new, you know. But he made everything count. It wasn't just silly things. It was counted, and it meant something to the song, as you were saying, you know.
Now I did jump out of line a little bit. I wanted to go back to the third Alcatraz album with Danny Johnson, and I was not a huge fan of that album. Do you think by taking nothing against his guitar player, I was very familiar with him before that. He's a good guitar player, but he certainly wasn't that shredded type or that technical type as the two before him. Do you think that type of guitar player hurt the sound of the band?
Probably, yeah, because I think people were expecting another Widdly Widdly.
Right.
And Danny's not that at all. He's a blues player.
He's a blues player, yeah.
He's more laid back. He's not Mr. Look How Fast I Can Play.
Right.
You know, and his songs are very sort of like bluesy. You know, he's a good songwriter, he really is. But that's when Alcatraz sort of died. You know, it's like, oh crap, what are we going to do? This is doing nothing. This album is not going anywhere, you know. And it didn't.
No, it didn't. Yeah.
And because it died a natural death and the band just fell apart. And that's when I moved to Australia for a bit, and then came back when Christian Pelletieri called me.
Were you happy with that Pelletieri album? Were you a fan of it?
Sorry, what?
The Pelletieri album. Were you happy with it? In retrospect, are you a fan of that album?
Yeah. I like the Standing Line is my favorite song, I think.
And Tonight I Fly is a tremendous song.
Tonight I Fly
is
a good one. And
Goodnight and Goodbye.
Oh, Good Night.
That's a good song too. The album was saved by a couple of really good songs. Yeah, it had it had like three or four really strong songs on it.
I think there were too. I loved the way Tonight I Fly. That was a good one. Yeah, that was a fucking high note in there.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, Chris said to me, you know, in the chorus, said, can you go a bit higher? I said, are you fucking kidding me? I mean, the fucking whatever atmosphere at the moment, stratosphere or whatever.
Without blood, bursting a blood vessel, I'll try.
Yeah. And I said, well, he said, well, why don't you go up to the high G above top C? I said, you're fucking kidding me? Because I'm get my guitar and going, it's all the it's right up there. I said, it'll just be a scream. He said, do it, go on. So I did it once. And I said, I tell you what, put that note in all the other choruses. I'm not doing it again. And that's what happened. We dropped it on the other choruses, that one note. Stupid. You know, it was bloody squeeze the balls and whatever else, you know. It was, oh, my God. I mean, I almost blew up when I sang that thing. But we actually did it a couple of times, and I managed to do it, and I don't know how. It was just a good day for me, I guess. The wind was blowing the right way.
Yeah.
Not sure. But now it is bloody high.
You were in another project I wanted to talk to you about very briefly, a Japanese band called Anthem. I was a big fan of that album. I bought it when it came out at the time. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we were over in Japan. Let's see, how long ago was it?
about 6 months ago, right?
When I wrote that?
Yeah.
It was like a year and a half. Yeah. November.
Now it's over. So.
It's the drummer's birthday today. Tamaru?
What was that? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
But now till the guitar player came and played with us when we played over there. And that album is, they're fucking great, that band. They really are.
Oh, yeah. Really good band. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I did that that album in my house. I remember doing the recording. And we had to translate all of the Japanese to English. And it was some of the lyrics came out very funny. So we had to change them. A lot of work went into making it sound sensible instead of like silly. But that band, I was really proud of that. We did, about 3 gigs in Tokyo together. And the place was packed and it was amazing, absolutely amazing.
Did you played about, was it back in November of last year? Did you do something with them? Did they have some sort of...
November the year before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Natural came on and played the guitar, which he doesn't normally play. Well,
that was for my birthday.
Oh, yeah.
That was June. Sorry.
I'm confused there.
But no, and then we went back again in November and you played with them.
Oh, right. Yeah. And I did... there's a guy that recorded a song of mine that I did on the lineup album called Night Games. And
great song.
Japanese version came out of that. And Naoto was something to do with the production of that. And it went got me to the studio and I sang along with the Japanese guy who was singing it in Japanese, obviously. And the Japanese, his manager was there and he was crying because I'm singing this song with his friend that departed, you know. It was kind of very touching, you know. And so I did it very quickly, I seem to remember, just singing the chorus with him. You know, it was kind of cool. But to hear it in Japanese was very confusing.
Yeah.
But it was good. He did a great version, you know. And that did well for me in England, you know. That was a single.
Mm. That's a great song.
Yeah, we do that live every night.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was featured in Orange is the New Black.
Oh, it was, yeah. Mm. I'm all over the bloody place. Gotcha. And every time something's featured in a movie or something, it's never my song. It's just me singing. Yeah, it's never a song I wrote.
we were streaming some British show, and all of a sudden I heard the riff, and I go, wait a minute, listen. And they were at a wake in a pub, and this drunk woman was singing Since You've Been Gone so bad.
Yeah, good. But it's funny. And then that band that took a bit of that disco song I did. Robin Gibber.
Yeah, Warm Ride.
Yeah, Warm Ride, yeah. And they put it into a song.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a rap song, wasn't it, or something? Something like that.
Kinda. I don't know. Indie of some sort, something weird.
Yeah.
But hey, whatever. You know,
again, I never wrote that.
As long as, you know, they're playing your song, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Certainly, little bits. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Going back, there's another band that I wanted to ask you about that you were in briefly called Black Thorn. A band that I had a moderate like for. I like Bob Kulick a lot. I think in a different... Yeah. I think if you... tell me if I'm wrong. In a different time, if you had recorded with Bob Kulick, would that have album possibly sounded different?
Without him?
If you recorded with Bob Kulick, but not in that 90s time...
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
In the vintage time, if you and Bob Kulick, say, did an album in 1986.
Yeah. I don't think it's the same. Apart from personality differences, you know, clashing personalities all the fucking time. It was very, I mean, it sounds like a cliche to say he was very hard to work with, but he really was. He didn't agree with anything. Every word I wrote, he would take the piss out of it and say, what the hell, what's this? What does this mean, Graham? I said, do you read it, Bob? Read it. What do you think it means? You know, he didn't understand lyrics at all. It had to be, you know, lick it up or something. You know what I mean? Lick it up, you know, come on, baby, listen. No. It had to be very plain and done to death, you know?
Yeah.
And He didn't get to a Desert Song, for instance. And we used to play that live. And he said, what is this about? He laughed at it. What does this mean? So I can't see me work. If I had the choice, I wouldn't have worked with him at all.
Okay.
He was not a very nice, his personality was just horrible.
You know, I knew Bob since I was a teenager, and he was really kind to me always, but he got a little bit, he was definitely crabby towards the end of his life, and he got so angry. I was on the phone with him, and he was trying to talk Graham into doing something that was so counterintuitive to his musical nature. And I was trying to, you know, sort of explain that to Bob, like, you're not going to get him to sing an AC/DC song. It's not who he is. Mm. And he got really mad at me. And, you know, it's a shame. I still have the message he left where he was threatening and combative. And I think it was just part of an illness because he died shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
And I choose to remember the sweet Bob. I still remember the moment I met him. I was wearing a strapless red velvet dress and I walked into like the Continental Club in New York. And he was at the bar having a drink, and he just like put the drink down dramatically and came over and said, "Who are you?" You know, that kind of thing. And we were friends for a long time. I got to see the side he was talking about. I hadn't seen it in the beginning at all.
Mm.
It was sweet to me.
Well, he was in a band in the early 80s called Balance. That was a really, really good band. Put out a couple of terrific albums.
Probably was in that band then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that they had those gold outfits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Gold shine looked like spacesuits.
Yeah, and he always kind of they lived in the shadow of his brother somewhat because the brother became. Although I think he was a substantially better player than his brother was. But
yes, actually, yeah. I mean Bob is a great player.
Great player.
He blamed it on not having hair.
Yeah.
Well, that too. I mean, he didn't really have the heavy metal look. Yeah.
Yeah. But no. And Bruce had the hair.
Yeah. Mm.
It was crazy.
So one more before I turn you over to Mark with more recent stuff. One more oddball band, a band you did with Dario Molo called Izu that a lot of people are not that familiar with. It was really a very good album.
Yeah. You know, I can't remember exactly what's on that Roddy album now. That was such a long time ago. But Dario's great. We went out to Dario, me, and Don Airey had a band for a while. We went, you know, around England. Dario's a really good writer, but I can't.
He is a good writer. He did some albums with Tony Martin a while back that were really strong.
Yeah. He's done a lot of different singers, Dario, you know. But that album to me now has completely gone from my memory. I can't even remember what was on it. You know,
there's oddly enough, there's a lot of people that don't know about that album. Like a couple of my friends who were big fans of yours never knew it existed. I was recently talking to a few of them about it. It got distributed in Japan too. It was signed to a Japanese deal. It's just like for some reason, and Dario Molo's stuff is out there. People know who he did a bunch of albums with Tony Martin.
Yeah.
It really didn't get like a lot of notoriety. Like,
no, it didn't. I know. So that's why I've probably forgotten about it, you know.
I don't know why they called it that either. Why did they call the band? Like, if he would have used his own name, I think it would have got a lot more attention because people in the metal community were very familiar with him.
I know. But when he played with us, it was the Airy Bonnet Band, Don Airy and Graham Bonnet Band, you know, and he was the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody knew who he was, you know, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Electric Zoo, I think he still uses that name, doesn't he?
He does still use it. I think he actually did another album with different singers on it.
Yeah.
I only have this one because you sang on it, but he does have another album out there.
Yeah. I can't really say much about that because of it. I don't know. We never do anything from that album, do we? No, we don't.
No.
There's nothing we...
All right. On that note, I'm going to turn you over to Mark.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, I finally ran out of steam after like an hour and a half.
Yeah. That bloody
my
album.
Balloon is emptied.
I'm going to see if I can push the next meeting back a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Because it's supposed to start in 7 minutes.
All right. Yeah. We're going to try to wrap up.
Yeah. No, it's all good. Hang on.
Well,
I'm doing this. Don't worry about you.
You want me to go?
Say anymore. I'm worn out.
Well, I wanted
I
wanted to get Beth involved because we were going to talk a little bit about the three Graham Bonnet Band albums, and so you know, do what you got to do.
Well, you start the Graham Bonnet Band. How did that start? The albums.
Well, I mean, you have 2016. The first one came out. Yeah, Bethany's involved in that one. Talk a little bit about that, you know, and those three albums that kind of came out. And I guess you said you're working on a new one.
Yeah. Am I talking or
him? Yeah, you do.
Go for it.
So when Graham and I met, he contacted me on LinkedIn, and I'm like, I honestly knew very little about Graham Beyond Rainbow. I knew nothing Beyond Rainbow. But he said, well, I'm always looking for new bands. And I thought, oh, well, maybe he's producing now. So I was playing with two different girl bands at the time. One I've been playing with since 1989. And one was, we'd put it together, it was two girlfriends and myself. The singer had a placement agent. She was that voice of that Macy's commercial with the Olivia Newton-John song.
Okay.
And so we were just trying to guess what songs were valuable, and we mostly recorded. We did two gigs. Anyway, I sent him links to both bands, and we started having back and forth exchanges, and I figured out pretty quick he liked my picture.
Yeah.
But in one of our emails, I said, you know, I don't want to go way into this, but I said, it's hard for me. I'm a single mom and I have special needs kids. And then he mentioned that he had a son with autism, and that's everything shifted for quite a while. I'd say at least 6 months, just talking about our children. And I was really interested because his kids are much older than mine. And I was just kind of looking down the pike. What can I expect? Anyway, but he sat in, my one band was playing at the Whiskey, and I invited him to do a couple songs with us. And he did No Matter What by Badfinger and Oh Darling by the Beatles. And I have never heard anyone so loud in my life. It was crazy. And it was so fun. And then, you know, you go upstairs at the Whiskey to get off the stage. And when we finished our set, he was waiting for me at the top of the steps. And he was like, oh my God, that was amazing. I want to be in a band with you. okay, yeah, cool. Let's do it. And I didn't really think much about it. And I drove you to the airport. Was it Brazil or Japan you went to on that one?
I think it was Brazil.
Okay.
I think.
Anyway, he got back from the trip and he said, all right, well, I fired myself from my band, so let's get started.
Yeah.
I'm like, are you kidding? Why would you do that? He said, he wasn't creating new material with them either. They never recorded anything. It was just a version of Alcatraz.
Yeah.
So we started, working together. And he said, well, who are we going to have on guitar? And I said, well, remember that guy that you played with at the Whiskey, Conrado? And he goes, oh, yeah, let's get him. So the three of us got together and just started, you know, building this baby, and it was really fun. It was a really fun experience for me. It was very different from being in an all-girl band, you know, and recording at our house as opposed to, like, I recorded at Electric Lady and, you know, mixed things at A&M. I've had some really elegant, high, you know, recording experiences, but it was really fun to do it at home. Obviously, we didn't do the drums at home, but, we called it Boudoir Studios because we were recording in the bedroom.
Yeah.
And we got together probably about a year into our friendship. We were in London. We'd been visiting some of my friends. And, I made a move. And I knew he loved me. I mean, he loved me from day one, he said. But, so that added a different element to everything, you know, when we were just partnered in every way at that point. And it's been well over a decade of us just trying to push this ball uphill, but things are growing the brand. And for me, it's not about me. You know, I'll talk about me till the cows come home, but ultimately this is about Graham Bonnet. And my goal from the beginning was to, you know, as I learned about Graham and his catalog and his experiences and his abilities, like, my God, I've never heard anyone write a song the way he does. Mm. He's a poet. He's brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
I remember I was learning, you know, And I was, you know,
about the bloody album.
I was listening to the lyrics, and I was like, "Oh my!" I said, "Did you put a chemical formulation in that song?" And he's like, "Yeah, I did." Like, it's amazing. But yeah, it was as I learned about his abilities as a front person, as a singer, you know, like, why aren't you huge? Why are you not a superstar? What happened? You're great looking. What happened? What happened was he kept quitting every band he was in and they were great and he kept leaving them. But I thought, you know, this is a last hurrah, because I think he was probably almost 65 when we met. And I didn't think, you know, I was like, oh, he's an old man. How much time does he have left? Well, now here we are. It's much further down the road. And he's still got not just the energy and the passion, but the voice.
Yeah.
The voice is stronger than ever. I mean, I do have to say I take a little ownership over that, because I don't let him get away with anything. Like, no, you can't have any more coffee. The doctor said it's all that acid, it'll ruin your vocal cords. He said he can't eat gluten because it'll cause inflammation. So, like, I really am on him, you know, about that. And I noticed by doing so, by really making sure that everything is what the doctor said, his voice has gotten more powerful as each day, each day goes by, you know? So anyway, so back to that album. So it was such an amazing labor of love for all of us, because we really, it was fun. There were no crabby Bob Kulick types, no clash of personality. It was just the three of us, you know, just the Three Musketeers, I still call us that. And then I had hired this manager who was really like a fanboy that I'd met backstage at an Axel Rudy Pell show that he did. But he was very bright and he knew his catalog better than Graham knew it himself. So I hired this guy, and I wish I hadn't now, because he turned on us. He turned on me like a rabid dog. I'm like, dude, I gave you a career. Why are you so hard? He tortured me on the road. It's why I quit Alcatraz. Like, I just couldn't deal with you know, just the misogyny and the racism. Anyway, I'm sorry. But yeah. That's what happened with that. But so the next, like, I love the first album. I think the production could have been better, but I love the songs. Oh my God. Welcome to My Home. Incredible. You know, just all those songs are really, really good. And the same thing with the second album. Even though it was a different guitar player on that one, I still think the songs are really good, but the production on that one, shit. It was a Jimmy Waldo production.
So. Oh, fuck you. Sorry. Oh, yes. Sorry.
The aforementioned torture.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't want to go there. But then on this last album, the last studio album we did, oh my gosh, I was so happy, because I thought, and I'm sorry for this expression, but I'm like, I hope we haven't shot our load for, you know, good songs. But oh my God, Graham pulled them out of nowhere, you know, and just the subject matter. I have to laugh because I don't know if you noticed, but there's something really saucy on every record. Like, meanwhile, back in the garage, there was Incest, Outcest, USA.
Yes, yeah.
and then on the more recent, you know, Brave New World was a little saucy, but Uncle John, geez. And that's a tough one. I get really angry, you know, having, being a child of that experience, you know, but I'm so glad that he's, you know, even though it's through music and that's not where you definitely want to, you know, you don't want to go to things that are so negative, but it somehow it works, you know. It's very cathartic for me when we play that song now. And the fact that the album charted in 4 positions on Billboard, I think that is a testament to it.
Oh yeah. I mean, a day out of nowhere. I mean, that, like you said, it has some great, just the songs, the lyrical content. And I mean, all the other two albums were strong as well, but I think there's something about that latest album. So it makes me really look forward to what you said. You're working on some new material, right? Is that a new Graham Bonnet Band album, right?
The sound on the last album we did is really, really good.
Yes.
You know, a labor of love from from Conrad. He really went through everything with me about vocal sounds and all the rest of it. And we finally found a microphone that actually suits my voice, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's Erland.
That's the difference in the sound of the voice anyway. Wow. It kind of picks up the chest sound and the whole body sound as much as it can for a microphone. Because when I recorded back in 1968, I've told this story a million times, I know, but in the studio, the engineer would come to me and say, let me... Here's three microphones all in a row. Now try this one, Graham. Now try this one. Sing the same bit on each microphone. And they picked the one that was nearest to how I actually sounded. But this microphone we have now just picks up my natural voice. It's amazing. Hmm. I'm really happy with it. It picks up the power. Yeah. Sometimes recording, and you're in a recording studio, the sound is not, you can't feel the sound like you can with this. Last album we've done, I think.
Yeah.
I can feel that. I can feel me singing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It just sounds good. And I think the songs are good too.
Don Eric called me and he said, I need to know the name of the song for publishing purposes. And I said, it's just a freaking song. He goes, I know, but I really need to know. And it felt like a who's on first type experience. I'm like, no, it's just a freaking song. That's we got a little giggle about that.
I wanted to use the word fucking. It's just a fucking song. Because it came from when you get frustrated, blank piece of paper is there and you went, okay, what can I make this up about? What can I write about? It's just a fucking song. That's I said it to myself and it became just a freaking song. Yeah. And Don know what he sent over a piece, for us to record to the keyboard part and that's how that song came to life.
Nice. Oh. So going to, I know you got another interview, so we're going to kind of wrap it up, but let's talk about next month. You guys back out on the road again. You're coming to this Midwest, the East Coast. Looking forward to seeing you guys at Sellersville, PA. That's for sure. How's it feel, Bethany, to come back to Jersey?
I can't wait. I've never played in New Jersey.
Really?
Never.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, yeah, we don't play in the States very much. Japan, the EU, and the UK. That's it. South America. But, it's good to... It's going to be so good to play at home, I left there a really long time ago. But it's all... there's always going to be a piece of me there, and I'm always going to take a piece of it with me. So, when I hear your accent, it just... it gives me the feels, I love Jersey. I did actually. I really loved being a kid outside, playing outside, lifting rocks, looking for salamanders, and just running through the horse fields there. I moved there. I don't want to give my age away, but it's like sometime during the Paleolithic era or whatever. but it was such a beautiful place to grow up. I didn't have the happiest childhood, but I was surrounded by just beauty. And I loved having four seasons. I miss that. I miss the smell and the taste of apples, proper apples. Because, I grew up, there were orchards everywhere. Sure. I have really fond memories of Jersey. People pick on Jersey. They make fun of Jersey, but Jersey rocks.
But Jersey's a really nice state. I mean, only been here a few years, but it's a marked improvement over New York.
Well, there. And I cut my teeth. I mean, I'm definitely going to give away my age, but I cut my teeth musically in the 70s in New Jersey and in Philly, going to see concerts at JFK and the Spectrum. Oh my God. I saw everything I could. I was so lucky. I saw Leonard Skinner. This is really going to give my age away. 2 weeks before the plane crash.
Oh, wow.
And it was just marvelous.
You see, I had tickets to see them at Madison Square Garden with Ted Nugent and the concert never happened.
I'm sorry.
I still have my ticket stub, but that was obviously unused.
I was a big Southern rock fan.
Me too. Huge Southern rock fan.
Before we let you go, I know Tom said you're a big Allman Brothers fan, right?
Me? Yeah.
Yeah. Huge. He saw the show last night, the brothers.
Yeah, at the Garden.
How was that?
It was tremendous. They played for 3.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah. They went on a 7:45 and the concert ended at 11:30.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they sold out 2 straight nights at the Garden.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that. Wow, that reminded me of a hockey game. I was like midnight and there were so many, like 120 penalty minutes. I was still there. I think it was like the Islanders and the Rangers were.
So you were into like Molly Hatchet and Blackfoot and all of that?
Not so much Blackfoot, but definitely, yeah. Molly Hatchet for sure, you know. Oh my God, Flirting with Disaster.
Yeah, I saw them on that tour.
Daniels.
I saw them on that tour at the Capitol Theater in New Jersey.
The Outlaws. I'm sorry.
I was big into the Outlaws too. I was big into Marshall Tucker.
Marshall Tucker, heard it, love song. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But you know, those, even though I love them, I cherish them. They were a little goofy. There was an elegance about the Allman Brothers that you wouldn't think would exist within that genre. They were the cream of the crop.
I never really considered them Southern rock, to be honest with you, because they really were initially blues based. And they never really fell into that, like you said, that kind of hokey, because a lot of those bands did really push the Confederate flag and, you know, like that. They really, the Allman Brothers never really did that, you know, like they really didn't push Southern rock, you know, like as it was like a genre, you know. They kind of like always stayed away from that.
That's like my go-to music when I'm sad. Mm. You know, that makes me feel better. It sort of validates my feelings, but it also lifts me at the same time.
Yeah. Wow. Well, hey, anything else, Tom?
I think
we know you got another interview to do. We appreciate your time, Graham, Graham Bonnet, Bethany Heavenstone. Thank you guys for talking to
Thanks
us
very much, guys. I appreciate the time.
Anytime. It's been fun.
Appreciate it. We'll see, hopefully see you in Pennsylvania in next month.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Great.
Take care.
All right.
See you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Thank you. Bye.